call it a mixed blessing at best. If you're known for something, and I mean worldwide known for something, and a event or news story crosses into that realm, you're going to get contacted about it. And not just through the regular channels either. When I get contacted by people about something they think is relevant to what I do, it comes through direct messages, texts, emails, in-person, phone calls, mentions on the Twitter stream, mentions in articles and Reddit. It comes from everywhere. And in the last 2 weeks, I had to get a lot of notification that Al Lowe was selling the Leisure Suit Larry source code. And he wasn't selling it to an institution or to a library or to a group who would preserve it. He was selling it on eBay. The story went on until a few days later, Al took the auctions down, citing a legal threat from Activision. At that point, I knew what I had to do. Read out the entire Leisure Suit Larry source code online. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to Jeff Atwood, Daniel Boyd, Backtracks FM, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who are helping me stay out of debt. Let's go about this a few ways. If you know anything about Leisure Suit Larry, you know all these details, but it's worth covering. A few years before Sierra Online came out with that title, a programmer named Chuck Benton had a small software company, and he made a very crude text adventure that was entirely based around hooking up and meeting girls. And he sold it by himself for a few copies, but then he was approached by Sierra Online at one of these conferences, and it was renamed to Soft Porn Adventure and sold with an incredibly racy cover involving one of the co-founders of Sierra Online along with a few other employees, and it sold very, very well for them. But they had to put it under wraps as they got a Disney license for other programs, and so the game kind of disappeared. But then a few years later, Al Lowe, working with Ken Williams, resurrected the program, put it into a more modern game engine, gave it graphics, and named it Leisure Suit Larry. Now, those details are everywhere. It's a game that is in no way defensible in the modern era. It's a relic of its time, making reference to the fact that it's a relic of a previous time. It's a game about a guy who is a virgin around the age of 30 or 40 who goes to Lost Wages, a town of greed and sin and maybe true love. And he goes around dealing with hookers, pimps, bartenders, casinos, and eventually gains enough money, I mean it literally is this, gains enough money to find love. A small confession, I've never really played this game. I didn't have a need to play it before. I really didn't play it when it was Leisure Suit Larry. So it was kind of a thing I knew about, and I knew details about it, but it wasn't really that important to me, and I didn't have any direct knowledge. And it was, however, always trotted out as an example of this interesting hybrid of dating game and adventure game and the way things could go with making games more adult and so on. And, of course, the controversy of sex in games. It was a easy target to reference. It was a case where, at least in some way, all of the relationships in it are basically consensual. You can have some debate about the hooker. There's a small amount of commentary about being someone who's just looking for sex. And the game itself actually has a lot involving blackjack and slots that make it a pretty effective casino game buried inside of the rest of this. Whatever quality Leisure Suit Larry has as a game was enough to spawn a good number of sequels. There's been at least six, and they are, of course, better and better in terms of graphics, commentary in varying directions, and, of course, people being pleased or displeased depending on how adult the situations are. I guess its adult nature makes it somewhat of a talisman for pointing out game history and what it represents and what does this mean or what does that mean, but at its core, it's just a simple adventure game. It's one that has all of the tropes of adventure games. There's a level of solving puzzles, of bringing this item here and that item there, and people giving you hints and using an ashtray off of a table to solve one adventure while having a bum give you a remote control clicker, which you give to a pimp to get to the hooker, and nothing really, really out of this world. But here we were, a number of years later, and people were finding out that the original source code was at risk, that Al Lowe was going to sell it to the highest bidder, to have it locked away inside of a collector's vault, never to be seen again, to be lost, to be reveled as a plastic object while the critical magnetic data inside disappeared and faded into obscurity. This is a very, very well-worn story, and it's one I've had to deal with in a lot of different directions. Of course, you've heard me talk about the importance of saving old software, but this one was particularly galling to me. Al Lowe has dealt with a large number of historians, both people who are programmers who had to update his material, all the way through to institutions, researchers, museums. They've all been in contact with him at various degrees. He's been incredibly generous with lots of interviews and oral histories and talking about his times at Sierra Online. He knew all this, and yet somehow he paints this picture in his interviews that he is, well, misunderstood, that he has these things and nobody wants them, and so he's just going to put them up. And I don't know where that came from, enough that I decided not to say a whole lot because it felt like this weird need to get some cash quick. Like, if Al was having trouble with something, I didn't want to step in the way and get in the way of him paying for medicine or a mortgage or something for one of his family needing something. I mean, I just didn't want to step in this because I knew that the Leisure Suit Larry source code was already out there. So let's talk about what the source code to Leisure Suit Larry is. Leisure Suit Larry is written in a scripting language. It goes with an engine that was developed for the King's Quest series. In fact, it actually has a lot of attributes of the King's Quest series, just redone so that instead of kingdoms, it's dance floors, and instead of landscapes, it's alleys, and so on. It's basically a scripting language that describes a series of variables and a series of descriptions of rooms and regions to allow a character, in this case Larry, to move around and interact with non-player characters, as well as defining what those non-player characters do and what they say and what can be typed in and so on. And so this is a game that is a simple script. And the code, as part of the really well-done Scum VM project, has been completely reverse-engineered for the Scum VM project. People knew what was inside of it and what it did and what linked to where and what text there was. They didn't have access to the comments that were written by Al Lowe himself, but the actual function was well and truly reversed and analyzed and discussed. It's a series of rooms, and here we get into working in a strange scripting language like AGI. You have a system of what are called rooms, and each one has attributes. And there's a magic in programming to fit analogs of reality into code. So when you see a forest and the forest has a lookout, often that has a whole different look if you read all of the mapping code inside. So even though in your mind it's a wide forest and you happen to climb up into a tree, to the code, it's two different discrete rooms, and they each have attributes, and the room that is climbing up the tree, even though it should be part of the other room, is in fact its own place with two exits up and down, and then all sorts of code to say that you can climb up or climb down or what can be heard from it and so on. I mean, there's a beautiful artistry to it that's worth going into some other time. Leisure Suit Larry has places like bars and alleys and bathrooms, and some of them are looking into people's faces, that is, close-ups, and some of them are playing games. The title screen is a room. It's a room with Larry chasing after a blow-up doll, and even though it restricts you from moving, it is, in fact, a room. So when you get your mind around all of that weirdness, there's actually some real clever things done by Al back in the 1980s to make Leisure Suit Larry work. It's actually a pretty simple interlocking maze that has a number of characters that you interact with the goal of a relationship with one of them, Fawn. And while there are other characters you interact with, you are doing it to gain items and eventually money to interact with Fawn. On Fawn's side, she is basically a final boss in terms of she has a series of objects that she needs. She needs a ring. She needs money to rent the chapel. She needs to be given gifts like chocolate and roses, and each of these are objects that you gain by going through different puzzles or being in the right place, or in some cases just by random. So once you think of it that way, the code starts to make sense. It's just a series of interlocking choices, and it's trying to make it as smooth as possible so that there are a bunch of words like open and lift that are synonyms, while also having five or six names for things like windows and trash cans and so on. You're basically looking at a massive decision tree, and the engine just simply allows you to guide a graphic character around small virtual locations to be able to make it seem like you're exploring. Now, getting back, not only is the reverse-engineered code out there, but the actual code that was written way back then by Al Lowe was out there. I mean, it wasn't sitting on a GitHub, and it wasn't sitting where people could easily find it, but I had access to a copy. Other people have access to a copy. It's definitely something that has been, quote-unquote, saved. I just had this inkling of an idea after Al Lowe pulled down the eBay and therefore had ended the story of he has code and nobody can have it. I thought, well, wouldn't it be fun to read the code out? I've been maintaining a Twitch stream. It's at twitch.tv/textfiles.com, spelled out, and I do all sorts of incredibly boring archival things there. I rip CDs or I digitize pages. It's just basically me having fun with that Twitch creative world where people are showing you art that they're working on, and then here's this guy doing incredibly tedious, never-ending metadata entry and scanning. And I like to demonstrate that it's not necessarily some sort of heroic act. It's often just starting at one point and moving on slowly and methodically until you get to the end. That is fundamentally the nature of what I believe to be honest work, staying through, not taking shortcuts, and getting it done. So, since I had this facility for being able to broadcast, I announced to everyone the previous day that I was going to do something special on a Tuesday at noon, and that I would announce what it was at 11:30. This was mostly because I thought that'd get some attention. It really didn't have anything to do with fear or concern, or that my windows were going to be bashed in by Leisure Suit Larry Protectorate. You know, just a little fun. So at 11:30, I announced that I was reading the Leisure Suit Larry source code, and I happened to be able to go through my wardrobe and find a leisure suit-like getup. And so, at 12 noon, I started to read the Leisure Suit Larry source code. Again, there's not really a lot of low-level programming in Leisure Suit Larry. That's all inside of the adventure game engine, which I don't have anything to do with and which I wasn't reading from. That's where all the low-level technical stuff is. This was a relatively high-level source code saying there's a room and the room is defined this way and here are the things you can do in the room and here are the commands that work within the room and so on. And definitions of global variables that are fed to different rooms. It's a series of descriptions. So I just started reading. There's about 128 files in the Leisure Suit Larry source code collection, and they range in size from a few bytes to 20 or 30K per file. There's a few that are binary, they're pictures, and then there's a bunch that are just the room definition, the global definition, and then a message file. And the message file is what you would expect. Message 2 would be something like, you are looking here and you see this, or no, Larry. That's not allowed. Just a bunch of decision points. If I'm somewhere in a weird realm describing this to you, I promise you that if you were to look at it for any amount of time, you would understand it in the same way that you would understand a train or bus schedule. It's all there. It's very descriptive of what things do what. And you can even parse out how puzzles are solved or what commands really work best and what Easter eggs there are. And you even start to see interesting priorities. For example, there is an enormous amount of code around the tying of a rope. And it reminds me of an interview I did with Dave Lebling for GetLand, where he said to me, don't ever, ever do a rope in text adventures. It's horrible. You have to show where it's being tied down. Then what happens if you leave the room? How do you indicate what things it's tied to, what the nature is, where it is in the room? Don't do a rope if you can. Well, Leisure Suit Larry does a rope, and being able to read all of the commands, literally the dozens of different lines related to the rope activity, really does make Dave Lebling's advice good. There's also a lot of code involving the bar, where you are walking around and interacting with different people. When people are not near you, you can't interact with them, yet you also want to have them respond different ways at different times. One of the people you interact with may become your girlfriend, so there's a lot of code to figure out what things you're carrying and whether or not they've talked to you. Meanwhile, there's all sorts of simple code involving things like, is there an ashtray still sitting on this table? Have you taken it? Do you have the ashtray? Is the ashtray in your possession? A lot of attention paid in one or two places where it's obvious the playtesters brought up issues, and then other ones where it's just one command that it's waiting for you to type and letting you win the game. I just started reading this out, and a lot of it was incredibly repetitive, and a lot of it was pretty simple to read. It was just a matter of saying, this verb is coming, here's this comment, here's the different responses, here's what these numbers are. And of course, being what it is, it's filled with profanity and sexual situations. It's got interesting personality aspects. The variable for the guy who works in the 7-Eleven, which is actually named something else, is Iranian. You never have him called Iranian, but his variable is Iranian. There are comments to playtesters and people doing conversions where Al says things like, never take this out, or there has to be a command here, or add this piece to this. The most code of all is around the blackjack game. The blackjack game in Leisure Suit Larry is so intense and has so many considerations for how the dealer works and how the game is played that it feels almost like it was written first, like it was written for something else and reused. I'm sure somewhere Al has discussed this. It's really, really well written, much more than anything else in the game. So if you're playing blackjack in Leisure Suit Larry, it's the best of all. So there I am, reading, and reading, and reading. Initially there's 8 people watching me read code. Then there's 16. Then there's 32. As word gets out about what I'm doing, it starts to go up to 50, and 60, and 70. Somewhere in there, one of the magazines that's a little late on research but really fast on turnaround announced to everybody that I was doing this, and suddenly the numbers jumped up to 150 and 160, 190 people, 190 people all listening to me reading source code at the same time. The comments are flying. Hour after hour is passing. Now, when I set out on this, I had a relatively good idea of how long it would take to read all of the source code. I figured it would be 5 or 6 hours. I can do 5 or 6 hours. You get a lot of water, pause every once in a while just to talk or to breathe, and you just keep going. People will forgive a little scratchiness or coughing here and there, and you just keep going at it. Well, when I got to 6 p.m. and I'm sitting there with well over 100 people listening to me, I quickly realized that it's not going to be 6 hours. It's going to be more. And I don't even know how much more. Now I realize I've dug a hole for myself. I've gone up on the flagpole to sit. I've announced I'm not leaving my room for a period of time, and factors I did not take into consideration are now becoming an issue. It's really not pleasant to sit in one location for 8 hours, reading line after line after repetitive line. It's not fun to look at a screen for that long without looking at anything else or doing any distractions or finding a way to take joy out of what you're doing outside of doing an occasional sing-song voice or imitating a different non-player character in some sort of accent that you've made up. Meanwhile, your throat's getting scratchy or your eyes are getting a little weary. You can't take a nap. You can't really go for a meal. And so I just kept barreling through. But, you know, somewhere there around the 9th or 10th hour, I rallied. I was able to start reading it with the energy that I had before and take joy in where I was and interact with folks back and forth as they asked me questions in the chat. It was, towards that last 25%, a delightful second wind. Buoyed, I might add, by this one little joke I had made. In the beginning, I had to classify my stream, and I declared that it was ASMR. It stands for Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response, but what it really means is people talking in low, clicky whispers and doing things so that people get a tingling in their head. And let me tell you, I am not a tingly experience. So what happened is that as more and more people went on to my stream, there were a whole other range of folks who were coming in and were screaming at us at, what is this? Get out of this area. Stop doing this. These were folks who were used to the usual ASMR folks. In the current era, ASMR streams are primarily women doing high voices with lots of whispering and bringing to folks a sense of quiet, gentle delight, which I promise you, my voice is not. So nestled in among the commentary on the code or discussion of the issues of code preservation were furious interlopers screaming at the fact that I was the top ASMR stream currently broadcasting on Twitch. And all it was a jerk in a leisure suit doing source code reading. It was a surge of energy for me, and I was able to get through all the way to the end. It turns out, to read the Leisure Suit Larry source code at a reasonable pace is about 11 hours of work. So, as my voice crawled over the finish line, I thanked everybody who had been listening, some of them for many, many hours, and told them once again about the importance of source code preservation and the institutions that I was encouraging folks to donate to, like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the Internet Archive and the Game History Foundation. And when I turned the stream off, I thought about everything I had done. And my final conclusion was, well, that was stupid. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to James Bekoyanu, Mark Pilgrim, Adam Green, and the hundreds of other supporters who have been helping me stay out of debt. So, the Leisure Suit Larry source code is fine. It's going to be protected. It's going to not disappear. There are, of course, many other source code repositories that are in danger, that are living on servers or in machines, and it feels strange to watch this happen over and over again, where people correlate the data being in only one physical location related to an artifact as being one of the features. And I'm trying to process that, the method of thinking that says, if the data on the floppy is only on the floppy, then the value is worth the risk to the data, as opposed to taking the data off of the artifact, perhaps selling the artifact, or in some way making the data available with the artifact separate from the actual artifact. It's only in realms like game history, where a lot of this hasn't been worked out in a way that it has filtered out to the general populace. So people are still coming up with their own conclusions, and as a result, machines that are historically critical are being tossed and then retrieved, and then in that moment of salvage, being treated like they're just a piece of metal that has a story instead of a piece of machinery that has a story that can be extracted from it. I don't know what the answer is here. I don't know if it's more articles. I don't know if it's more stunts, more readings, more making noise, or the work of places like the Software Preservation Network or the Software Heritage Foundation or the Computer History Museum to make people aware that all this stuff is so critical. I'm sure we'll work it out one of these days.